record.
Hello.
Hi, radio.
Hello.
Oh, is this radio? I suppose it is, yeah.
This is radio.
Just get your ID yourself to say your name to the mic.
Christopher Nolan.
Chris, I'm going to ask us right off, because I know it's been part of every interview, but it's something that certainly is in a lot of people's minds, is the work that Heath did. Having seen the film now, it's just truly remarkable that what you and he were able to create in terms of the character. What was your sense? Because we got a little bit of insight from Aaron saying that there were a couple of scenes that were not rehearsed in character, so that you just had it happening mm-hmm. while the cameras were rolling. What was your sense of, and I guess, what kind of cliff were you diving off together in order to see him create that?
The thing with an actor taking on a role like this and producing such a sort of unique and special performance is very often in rehearsal, you don't want to see too much of what the actor's going to do. So you tend to treat the rehearsal, if it's a scene like the one between Aaron and Heath in the hospital, where the blocking is very simple, you tend to just treat the rehearsal as a fairly simple blocking rehearsal, figuring out where to put the camera, the order in which to shoot the scene, that kind of thing. And you let the actors save something for what they're going to do. Because with simple setups like that, where it's just two guys talking in a very controlled physical environment, you can really just let the camera run and let them explore things and have fun with it. And when you have two great actors working at the same pitch, you'll get great results from that.
Where, in terms of creating the Joker character, and you had iconic images that we've had from Jack Nicholson, and as David pointed out, there's also Cesar Romero. So
yeah,
there are other images that people can see if they want to pop them in the video. How do you erase those from your own mind or from the audience's mind? And how do you think Heath did?
I don't think it was really an issue for us to erase them. We were trying not to be reactive in any sense. We weren't going to not do things because someone else had done them before. It was more a question of just trying to be true to the terms of this story and the tone of telling the Batman story that we had established with Batman Begins, which has a bit of grit to it, a bit of reality to it. We've tried to push that even further in The Dark Knight. And when Heath and I first talked about the Joker and what the Joker would need to be in this telling of the story, it was very apparent to both of us that it was going to be something very different than it had been done before, not out of a reaction to previous incarnations, but because the story demands something different. It demands something very frightening, very palpably real, and potentially dangerous. And we, really focused in on this idea of the Joker as an absolute force of pure anarchy, somebody devoted to chaos, somebody who truly does just take pleasure in tearing down the world around himself. That's the fear we wanted to inspire in the audience. That's the threat we wanted underlying everything in the film. And that's something we've not seen from this character before. Heath was able to put together a number of different things, I think, a number of different attitudes for the character, and in the process create an iconic representation of the Joker. And the Joker does need to be iconic, and Heath understood that very much. But he never loses sight of the humanity of the character. The fact that the character is a real human being and therefore is a real dangerous force.
I want to get some sort of grip on a timeline here, if you don't mind. Were you completely finished with Heath when he passed away?
He was on another film. It was months and months, since we'd wrapped and we'd really cut a lot of the film together and had watched the film a couple of times, We were about halfway through the edit process.
So he had seen it and he had a reaction to it?
Unfortunately, he'd only seen the prologue. He'd only seen the introduction to his character that we shot with these IMAX cameras and put out as a sort of short film in IMAX in the Christmas. And we screened it for him and he enjoyed it very much. And I'm very pleased that gave him a taste of how it was going to come across. But I was obviously never able to show him his finished performance. And whilst that's very sad, I'm certainly very gratified and very relieved to see that people seem to be getting from his performance what he wanted them to get.
Did we lose any of the Joker scenes in the cutting room?
Not whole scenes. I very rarely remove scenes from my films as a writer-director and as a director who can't bear to take time shooting things that aren't going to be in the film. I try very hard to not shoot things that we're not going to use. And really, it's all in there in the movie. I mean, obviously, certain lines have to go and certain little things for time and for the cleanness of the story and everything, but not whole scenes.
No. You would never shoot anything then specifically to be added in a DVD?
No, I'm a big fan of theatrical film. That is what I do and what I want to do. The DVD, it's a great format and it's a great sort of archival format for the piece, but I much prefer people to see the definitive version of the film in theatres.
Well, how do you feel then about the deluxe special edition Memento that came out that might have set the bar for extra features?
Well, the extra features, I think, are terrific on that DVD, and they were put together very much by my brother Jonah and the team of people working with him. And we put a lot into what was a pretty fledgling form at the time in terms of the complexity of it and the interest of it. But there aren't any deleted scenes because we couldn't afford to shoot anything that wasn't in the movie on that film. The film that's on that DVD is the same as the one that was in theatres. That, to me, is important. The other special features, the other things around the feature on a DVD or these days on a Blu-ray disc, I think they can be very interesting and very worthwhile, particularly for people who are interested in the craft of filmmaking. But I believe that you have to fight constantly for the definitive version to be the theatrical version. You don't want to be bought off by promises from people that, okay, take it out of the film, but we'll let you put it on the DVD. I think that's losing that struggle.
I'm sure you like to work with the same crew members, if you can, from movie to movie and bring mm-hmm. them along. As the scope of your movies, like this one, gets bigger and bigger, you must be very proud of your people that they're rising to the bigger challenges.
Well, you know what they say, it's all in the direction. No, it's fabulous working with the same people, and one of the reasons that I have worked with the same people is because if you take, you know, my director of photography, Wally Pfister, or my DP, you know, Nathan Crowley, or my brother Jonah, who I write with, we've grown up together. And it's fun to work with people who haven't done the thing you're doing 10 times before with other people. It's fun to work with people for whom it is new and fresh, and it's a challenge the way it is for you as a director.
I hope nobody said, gee, we didn't mean for that to explode.
No, it was all pretty well controlled and pretty carefully put together. I think that people working at this level, there's a lot of care and attention that goes into everything, and we have great resources to make the film, and we try and get as much of that on screen as possible and use it in as efficient a way as possible.
Chris, I can certainly understand the idea of surrounding your film with secrecy, especially with how invasive the internet can be, but having your actors walk down the street with shrouds over their heads, I'm wondering whose idea that was, how that came about, and how you felt about it.
Well,
I mean, I get a very comical image in my head.
You do, and it can be a little comical to look at, but the truth is, if you want to preserve, it's not entirely a question of secrecy. What's important is that the idea of what we're trying to do, the vision and the ultimate execution of what we're trying to do, it needs to be, in certain elements, held under wraps until it's ready to be seen. And it is not fair nor appropriate that people try and, you know, remove that veil of secrecy too early. Creating things in film, it's no different to creating things in music or anything else. You want to be finished with what it is you're doing before people see it and weigh in on it and judge it. And in this technological day and age, that becomes increasingly difficult, and you have to be more and more careful about the way in which you try and preserve those the secret of what you're doing.
Funny looking as I imagined?
I think it was actually quite sinister, to be honest. These very dark sort of shrouded figures wandering around. It actually added quite an aura of mystery to the set, and it certainly makes everybody on the set pay attention when these characters turn up, whether it's Christian, whether it's Heath, whether it's Aaron as Two-Face. But it's important to preserve the mystery behind films. And I think it's a shame that people allow their curiosity to too much, you know, tear down that that veil of secrecy that always used to surround the process of making the film. I think the DVD culture has done that to a degree as well. I think there's perhaps a little too much focus on some of the extras, on exposing all of the secrets of the film and telling how everything is done and showing everything that underpins a film.
One thing I loved the most about the movie maybe is the fact it didn't seem set-bound at all. Mm-hmm. You know, it was all real places. It might as well have been James Bond, mm-hmm. you know, in the scenes. And I just wonder, what made you try to get that? Because, you know.
Well, in moving the story on and doing a second film, you feel a real responsibility to try and do something sort of bigger and better. And we shot quite a lot on location on Batman Begins, but not as much as we'd like to have. So we just pushed further and further in that direction. We pushed further in the direction of saying we want the film to get its scale by being realistic, by being shot on a real-world scale. Because a real location, whether it's a city street exterior, or whether it's the interior of a boardroom, for example, the real world is built on a scale that sets and studios simply can't match. So if you want a real world scale, if you want to get scope into the film that way, you're going to have to shoot in real places.
Speaking of scale, talk about the decision to do some of the IMAX stuff and what kind of complications that presented.
I'd wanted to shoot on the IMAX format for many years. As a kid, I used to go watch documentaries in the Museum of Science and Industry in Chicago on the Omnimax screen. This film format is the most high resolution, sharpest, you know, most clear film format ever invented, but it's never been used in Hollywood films before, which seemed crazy to me. So we set about shooting our main action sequences using these cameras. They're very large, very heavy, very cumbersome, but we had a great crew, put a lot of time and preparation and effort into figuring out how to move these cameras, how to manipulate these cameras, the same way we do with our 35mm cameras.
Does this slow you down at all?
I'm sorry?
Does it slow you down, or can you pre-plan and schedule and make sure that works?
We actually found ways to not make it slow us down. We thought it would slow us down, so we came up with various means to try and save time on the reloads and things like that, swapping cameras in and out, using multiple camera bodies and things. And I think we were so afraid of the format and of what it might do to our production schedule, and we prepared it so meticulously that it actually went very, very smoothly, and we wound up using the format more and more as the film progressed.
Did you get two composers on the movie?
Yes.
It's rare we see two composers.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about that?
Yeah.
I'm sorry?
Can you just talk about that?
Well, Hans Zimmer and James Newton Howard collaborated on the music for Batman Begins. It was Hans and James's idea. I had gone to Hans with the film and wondered if I could interest him in doing the music. And he came back with this proposal that the two of them work together. They'd been friends for years, and they'd been wanting to find somebody to experiment on in terms of letting them work together as a unit. They're great friends and extremely good collaborators, and they each bring something very, very different musically to the table. And I think their collaboration on this film was pushed quite a bit further than it was on Batman Begins. They've retained a lot of the things that I felt they'd done very well on that film that I wanted them to retain. But they've pushed forward in a lot of new directions, and I think the sound they've come up with is very unique and adds an enormous amount to the emotional life of the film.
Whether you're making a film noir or not, it seems your movies have noirish elements in that. I'm just wondering, is that a conscious choice? Do you look at material and say, oh, I want to consciously try to inject, or is that just what you do? Is that part of
I think I've always just gravitated towards stories in which character is defined through action. That is to say, the story of the film is telling you who the people are. I think that's the strongest form of characterization, and it's one that finds its most obvious incarnation in things like film noir, in those genres where you're expecting the double cross, the reversal, all the rest. The process of going through the story to a certain extent is the process of continually appraising what you think of those characters, who the good guy is, who the bad guy is, where your sympathies lie. In this genre, it shifts through the film, and I'm interested in stories with complicated characterizations where your sympathies can shift.
Why is your next project, The Prisoner? What's that about for you?
Well, I don't know specifically what it is we'll be doing next. I am working on a version of The Prisoner, which is a a television program I've admired for a very long time, and I think would make a fantastic movie. But I don't yet know whether that'll be next.
Is that for BBC Television?
No. I think BBC Television is doing a television version. We're looking at doing a large scale feature of it.
Picking up on the phrase you've used a couple of times, real world. Mm-hmm. There is an attitude. I joked with Jonathan and David about you could subtitle this film "The Trouble with Heroes." And there's an attitude toward vigilantism and going it alone that I think reflects perhaps a change even in just the 3 years since Batman Begins came out, and it was being celebrated now. There are mm-hmm. questions being asked in this film. Does that reflect, do you think, of you that's in the zeitgeist, or is that just a coincidence of where we are in the world right now?
No, I think that if you were to watch Batman Begins again now, I think you would actually see very much the seeds of what this film thinks and says about vigilantism, about what Batman is doing. I think that the nature of the origin story was one in which you have a natural rise to power of the character, and so there's an inherently positive spin on these elements. But I think the seeds of where that's going to go and how that might be misconstrued or abused or misinterpreted, I think it's all there in that film. It's just that in this film, we get to really run with it and take it someplace different, someplace darker.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.